that much in this course from just this time watching the video without sound, so I hope people can hear what I'm saying. Okay, now today I want to first say to those of you who stuck it out for the second lecture, I have some good news. Remember in the first lecture we were talking about Robert Nozick's argument for the minimal state. Probably you found this lecture rather on the hard side. It's a very intricate argument that Nozick was giving for the state. Nozick had quite convoluted mind. So, you know, I mean, Nozick would write, you'd have to pay attention to every detail. So it was a rather difficult lecture. So the good news is that was the most difficult lecture in the course. If you've gotten through that one, then the rest of the lectures, I think, would be somewhat easier. They also have arguments that are sometimes a bit hard to follow, but I don't think you'll find them as hard to follow, if you did find it hard to follow, as you found the Nozick one. If you didn't find the Nozick one hard to follow, you're certainly doing better than I did when I read the book, but you'll find these then even easier. Now, the philosopher we're going to be considering in today's lecture is a very different philosopher from Nozick, although the two knew each other slightly. Nozick was a libertarian, at least for most of his career as a philosopher. There's a brief period when he probably wasn't a libertarian, but then he converted back. But the person we're talking about today, G.A. Cohen, also Jerry Cohen, was the way his friends referred him. He was very definitely not a libertarian. Quite the contrary, he was a Marxist. He was a leader of a particular group of Marxists who were called analytic Marxists. And the reason they were called analytic Marxists was that they thought, even though they were Marxists, they thought there was a lot that was wrong with the conventional Marxist theory. They thought some of the Marxist theory wasn't very rigorous or had objections that conventional Marxists weren't able to meet. So they thought that if we applied the techniques of modern analytic philosophy and economic theory to Marxism, we could come up, or they could come up with a much better version of Marxism. And so this movement isn't as prominent as it used to be maybe in the late 1970s, 1980s, kind of died out, but it was quite influential, and Cohen was one of the leaders of that. His foremost work in the analytical Marxist tradition is a book called Karl Marx's Theory of History, a Defense, which was a very exact statement of historical materialism. Cohen always remained sympathetic to Marxism throughout his life, but he thought that even after a while, that even with this reformulation, he was trying to make Marxism more rigorous, the analytical Marxist had undertaken, he thought that he couldn't really show that Marxism was correct. In other words, he's trying to come up with a better version of Marxism, a more rigorous version, but he couldn't come up with a rigorous version that he also could prove to be true. And he thought that the theory of history that he described very carefully in his book, couldn't show that it was correct. It was open to certain objections. One of the objections in particular was required him to come up with a different basis from conventional Marxism for supporting socialism. In the standard Marxist picture as capitalism develops, more and more people are driven into the proletariat, the working class. Capitalism lowers the standard of living for people. It gets rid of the middle class, drives the majority of the population into the proletariat. So then when the majority of people are in the proletariat, then they'll overthrow capitalism and replace it by socialism. So it turned out, as you know, if you look at the advanced capitalist economy, that what Marx said wasn't true, that the majority of people didn't become forced into the proletariat. If you look, say, at Germany in the late 19th or 20th century, was about a third of the population was in the proletariat, didn't get to be the majority. This was a criticism that had been raised against Marx by the 19th century by Werner Sonnenberg, who was one of the leading lights of the German historicals. So he'd start off as a Marxist, became very anti-Marxist later in his life. So why, you have to ask why, well, why is this point about what's wrong with the Marxist theory of history relevant for us in the lecture debate? Well, in the conventional Marxist view, you say, well, why should we have socialism rather than capitalism? This is really a non-question, because in the conventional Marxist view, we're going to have socialism anyway. So it isn't a matter of saying socialism, we should institute socialism because it's a better system than capitalism, it's an ethically better system. It's just that's what we're going to have. That's where history is going. But Cohen now thought that couldn't be shown to be true because they can't show that the proletariat is going to get into the majority. So we can't show the coming of socialism is inevitable. So then if the coming of socialism isn't inevitable, then we have, Cohen had the problem of, why should you favor socialism? He's a socialist, but can't, no longer accepts the theory that the coming of socialism is inevitable. So then he has the question, well, why should he favor socialism? And the answer that he gave was an ethical one. He thought that socialism was an ethically better system than capitalism. I imagine this is a view that most people who are in this course wouldn't agree with. But in particular, he thought that in under a capitalist system, if you're a free market, we have a great deal of inequality. Some people are much more wealthy than others. There are all sorts of people who have more money than I do, unfortunately. But Cohen thought that large-scale inequality was bad. So he wants to say, look, we should have socialism because under socialism we'll have equality, not inequality. So, however, he had a problem. Remember, he's trying to come up with ethical arguments in favor of socialism. So the problem he had was that he also thought that the principle of self-ownership is very plausible. Now, you all know, I assume, what self-ownership is. And self-ownership would be the view that each person ought to have control of matters affecting his or her body or his or her person. For example, where you work shouldn't be up to the state, but it's up to you to make whatever arrangements you want with other people in getting a job. No one can compel you or force you to work for them. So self-ownership seems a very plausible principle, and Cohen agreed with this. Self-ownership does seem very plausible. So why is this a problem? Well, if you accept self-ownership, then you're going to have an argument that gets to libertarianism. if you look at Rothbard or Nozick, you know, you're people are familiar with the idea that people own themselves and then they can acquire property by mixing their labor, doing something to unowned land and they acquire it, you get to a system of libertarian. I guess the one Michael is asked that socialism seems to be driven by the zero-sum game idea. Well, to some extent, I don't know if I'd agree with that in part because a socialist would hold it's desirable or it's likely that the economy will be growing, but we still shouldn't have inequality. So a socialist would say he isn't saying that one person can only gain at somebody else's expense. He's saying even if we all gain the distribution should be equal. And so I'll just give one more now. I just want to basically stay on the lecture. Somebody said, how did Cullen respond to the argument of economic calculation of socialist economy? Well, he didn't deal with that too much. He just hoped that people would be able to solve it. But he thought if they couldn't, that wouldn't show that socialism wasn't the best, the most ethically desirable system. It would just show we couldn't have a most ethically desirable system. It would be bad news if ethically means were correct. But now, to return to the main thread of my lecture, assuming I haven't forgotten it. So we have a problem that Cohen wants to give an ethical argument to, let's say, socialism is a better ethical system than capitalism, but he also finds self-ownership a plausible ethical and moral principle, and self-ownership seems to lead to libertarianism. So the problem, obvious problem is, well, he can't be both a libertarian and socialist, so what is he going to do? Now, there are two ways Cohen could respond to problems. I mean, the problem is he wants to support socialism, but he's also sympathetic to self-ownership, and self-ownership seems to lead to libertarianism, which is inconsistent with socialism. So he has two ways of responding to this problem. The first one, and he pursues both of these strategies, the first of them is to accept self-ownership, says, yes, I do accept self-ownership. It is a good principle. But to say, this doesn't lead to libertarianism. It doesn't have to lead to libertarianism. So this strategy says, well, you can accept self-ownership, but then you don't have to accept libertarianism along with it. So you can still be a socialist and you should accept self-ownership. And the second strategy is to say, that even though self-ownership seems a plausible principle, when we think about it more, we should reject it. So it has something to be said for it, but we really shouldn't accept it. So he's going to pursue both of those strategies. Now, we might say, well, why should we accept self-ownership? Why does Cohen find it at least the first one he wants to accept? And it, he always thinks it's plausible, even when he comes to raise objections to it. Now, he mentions this example to kind of motivate acceptance of self-ownership. And this example, I think, has also been used by Ayn Rand. Most people have two usable eyes. Most of us, we're fortunate, have two eyes that we can both can use to see with, but some people don't have any eyes that enable them to see. They can be blind in both eyes. So the latter group of people, people who don't have usable eyes at all, would benefit from eye transplant. Supposing I was willing, I have to both of my eyes work, so I give an eye, I'm willing to donate an eye to somebody who's blind. Now, I'd still be able to see with one eye instead of two, although I wouldn't be able to see as well, I wouldn't be able to see things in depth the way I did before. I would still be better off than somebody who was blind, but someone who couldn't see at all who got an eye would be much better off because he couldn't see at all. Now he's got one eye. So suppose somebody argued, well, if you redistribute eyes through the system of eye transplant, people as a whole would be better off. This kind of utilitarian argument. Of course, there are all sorts of problems with making utilitarian arguments. And supposing you put those aside and say, well, wouldn't people be better off as a whole making these eye transplants? So should we favor such transplants? Not just say people, it would be a nice idea if people want to do that, but should we say people should be forced to have two eyes, should be forced to give one up to those who didn't have any? Now, I think you think about this and see, well, obviously, we shouldn't favor the system of compulsory transfers. Even if some people would be better off as a result of eye transplant, each person has the right to decide what to do with his or her own eyes or body in general. I think if we just think about this, what's possible. Or let's take an example that isn't quite as unusual. That probably a lot, most of you or all of you come across blood drives where sometimes people will. The university that they give blood to donate blood to help out. Now, supposing that you don't feel like donating the blood, should the people conducting this blood say, we have the right to force you to give even if you don't want to? I think most of us would say no. Even it would be a nice idea for you to donate blood, then you don't have to. What if you just didn't feel like doing it as a thought? Or giving blood made you feel bad because it wants you. Wouldn't it be up to you because it's your own body? I won't resist here telling the story of, talk about blood drugs. The man who wanted to become a tree surgeon, but he had to give the idea up because he couldn't stand the sight of staff. I hope that everybody who likes to pass the course should laugh at this point. Okay, so we have then this principle of self-ownership seems very plausible. It's very difficult to reject. Now, well, I'm glad Leslie likes the joke. Good for Leslie. Okay, now, when I'm talking about self-ownership, some people, I should say, don't like the term self-ownership because they say, well, if you say self-ownership, this implies some kind of separation between the self and your body, and that isn't right. Some kind of dualist position where the mind is only the body. But even if you don't like the term, it doesn't really matter because it's the concept that's important. All we mean by self-ownership is that each person has the right to decide on questions involving his body or where he should work and so on. It doesn't matter if you don't like the term self-ownership, we'll call it something else. Now, if you accept self-ownership, then the way to libertarianism seems clear. And I've already indicated this in part. A little bit before, don't people who own themselves have the right to appropriate property? Imagine, well, here's all this property, unowned land out there, and you have people, each of them, each person owns himself or herself, so don't they have the right to go out and homestead property, and they acquire the property, and that's how we people come to have individual property rights. So you can see why is this going to be a problem if you're a socialist? Well, it doesn't seem like there's any room for socialists in the state to get started because supposing somebody said, well, everybody should have equal wealth, we should live in a socialist society where everybody gets the same amount of wealth. Well, but what if you required property, homestead as a property, then you have a right to your property that blocks action to achieve these egalitarian goals. Somebody says, well, you have a lot of, you earn a lot of money, say you're a big baseball star, so you earn a lot of money, so we're going to take away some of the money you have. After all, you don't need it, and I'm going to give it to the poor people. So you could say, look, this is my, I'm just getting this money because I, self-owner, a wage bargain with other people, and this is what I'm going, wages are due to me, and if I don't choose to give them to the poor, there's nothing you can do about it. So the structure of the argument against egalitarianism, against socialism, is just like the argument against the eye transplant. Remember, even if the eye transplant is seen over taking one eye from those who have two usable eyes and giving the eye to someone who doesn't have any usable eye, it will make people better off overall. The person's rights to their own body blocks this move. So in Nozick language, rights are side constraints. In fact, what I mean by side constraints, there are limitations on what people can do. Supposing, say, you're playing basketball, the aim is to score as many points as you can. Well, you can't say, well, one way I could score a point is just to climb up on the ladder and stuff the basketball. The ball in the basket, and then, or just get an armored tank in and block the other team from doing anything to stop you from shooting. There are certain rules you have to follow that define the game. So similarly, the right here blocks is a rule that tells you you can't do certain things you may be trying to achieve a goal. So that. Sense in which you ride to the side constraint. So, as I've already suggested, aren't plans to redistribute wealth blocked by property rights? So, socialists say, well, we want to redistribute wealth. We don't like because inequality is very bad, but still, don't the individuals who are self owners who acquire property by mixing their labor with unowned land, haven't acquired property, so no one has the right to take it away from them if they don't want to give it. So how can a socialist escape? Now, does anybody have any idea? If you've seen my slides, you'll know, how do you think Cohen gets out of this argument? Remember, the problem is he accepts self-ownership, but he doesn't want to accept the libertarianism. So how do you think she gets out of that? Now, if you looked at my slides, you already know, but does anybody have any ideas? Has to look at the slide. Yes, that's right. Leslie said, reject the right of appropriation of property. And how would you, Leslie, how would you think he's going to do that? I suppose somebody said, well, look, there's all that unowned land out there, and I'm a self-owner, so why don't I have the right to take some of it? I think you're getting at the right, you're in the right area. Good. Let's go on. Well, as I say, he needs to block the step from self-ownership to acquisition of property by individuals. And people are coming up with particular ways of collective ownership that are basically on the right track. But you have to get sort of the underlying principle it isn't just collective ownership, but it's kind of an underlying principle that's vital if you're going to understand Cohen's argument. So what he says is there's a problem in the libertarian argument. Remember, the libertarians are people who start off, people are self-owners. Here's this unowned land, other resources, individuals can now go out and acquire it. So the assumption is that land, rather resources, starts out unowned. If there's no unowned land to start with, we can't get individual acquisition. So he's saying, look, it isn't just that self-ownership implies libertarian acquisition. You have to add this other premise that there's unowned land or resources. Now, you might think, well, isn't it obvious that the land starts out unowned? What would be the alternative to it? And this is where we get into what people suggested already, is you could have a situation where everyone in the society owns all the land collectively as a group, or you could have another alternative. It would be individuals have a right to an equal division of all the resources in the territory. Now, it's crucial to see what Cohen is proposing here. He's not, this is the misunderstanding I think people are likely to fall into if you're familiar with standard libertarian view. He's not suggesting that groups rather than individuals homestead property. He's not saying, well, we shouldn't say that individuals go out and homestead property, something like, well, I imagine some people on an island and I see some area that I think I could grow some food here, so I'm going to fence this off and grow food there. He isn't saying, instead of saying individuals are doing, let's imagine there are groups of people doing this, their homesteading. That would be quite compatible with standard libertarian theory. You could imagine, say, the group we have started with, people who are self-owners, all the land in the area is unowned. So the groups get together and say, well, let's jointly acquire this property, we'll agree to distribute it, distribute the gains in a certain way. We'll all get together and start farming this particular land. That would be quite compatible with standard libertarian theory. But what Cohen is saying is something else. He's saying that we start out with people having the collective rights to equal distribution of all the resources. It isn't that we're assuming that the land and resources start off unowned and people just acquire the resources by getting together as a group and homesteading particular plots of land. We're starting off with the assumption that people have rights to property, or collectively rights, equal rights to all the land and resources. Now, probably what you would think when you first hear this, and this would be kind of a very good libertarian reaction to these proposals, well, what is his defense for using these views? Why is it the case that people have the collective property rights, or why is it that people have the right to an equal distribution of all the resources in a certain territory? And that's a very good question, but it's really missing what Cohen is trying to do. He isn't arguing that either of these two proposals is correct. He isn't saying, well, I, Jerry Cohen, think that people have this collective ownership to all the resources. People start off as self-owners and they also have this collective right to decide on all the resources. He isn't endorsing that particular combination, as we will see later, he himself doesn't accept self-ownership. What he's arguing here is he's not saying either of these views correct, well, all he's trying to do is to say that because there are these alternatives or these alternative systems, the move from self-ownership to libertarianism isn't one that we're logically required to make. So we don't have to say, I accept self-ownership, therefore people have individual property rights based on homesteading, because there's an additional assumption, additional premise, namely that land and resources starts off unowned. Now, you might say, well, what Cohen is saying isn't really much of an argument, because maybe he's come up with some alternative where you don't have to accept homesteading, but supposing the alternative is completely implausible, what good would it do just to show, well, there's some logically possible system where we can accept self-ownership without accepting libertarian property acquisition? If the alternative is never good, if it's completely crazy, what would be the point of coming up with this alternative? Now, you might think that the first alternative is totally unworkable, because if everybody owns all the property collectively, doesn't this mean that any individual could veto any use of land by someone else? Suppose you said, well, you just go out like to farm this particular area. I say, no, you can't do that. And then you couldn't do it because, after all, I'm one of the co-owners. So we could have a situation where everybody vetoes everything. Whenever anyone wants to do something, there's at least one person who objects. So nobody would be able to do anything in the system, that just people would just die, the system would collapse. And Rothbard raised this objection to the system of collective ownership. He didn't have Cohen in mind, but he was considering alternatives to self-ownership. He raised this question, well, if you understand collective ownership, then people couldn't do anything. But he didn't have Cohen in mind, but he dealt with this and defined the ethics of liberty and discussed this case. But what Cohen didn't get out of this objection, because he didn't have in mind a system in which anyone could always veto everything. He thought the system he had in mind was that people would agree on a distribution of resources to individuals. So what we would have was, in this system, people are born, everybody in society has the right, as a group, have the right to, they own all the resources. It's not something that's acquired by homesteading. So the people born with this right as part of the collective in the society, they own all the resources. And then as the co-owners, they would come up with some agreement on how to distribute them. Now, Cohen thought at first, at any rate, or at least in one of his articles, he thought the distribution they'd agreed to would probably be an equal one. He thought, again, the individuals own the property as a group, and they have to come up with some arrangement to distribute it, because otherwise they won't be able to live. They have to sign shares. And Giuseppe, on the one who's distributing, can decide what to do with it. Doesn't really specify that, but the assumption is you would, with the years, and as I mentioned later, that could generate certain inequalities to get people to start offering equal share. And what was the reason Cohen thought people would agree to equal distribution? Say, what if some people were much more productive than others? Wouldn't they say, well, look, we're able to produce more than you are, so why should we have to give you equal shares of anything we produce? Why don't we have a system where we're more productive, we get more? So Cohen answered this and said, well, if the more productive people suggested that, they said, we want more because, after all, we're producing more, we think we should get more. The ones who weren't so productive would say, we won't agree to this. If you insist on this, we're just going to veto your proposal. So the only way they could get any benefit from their superior productivity would be to agree to equal distribution. Now, there's a big problem in this argument that Tom Palmer pointed out, and I gave you the assigned reading was his article. And he objected that Cohen's argument isn't right. And remember, Cohen's argument is if the more productive people wanted to have more shares, want to have more property, more resources, because they're more productive, then the ones who weren't so productive would just say, no, we veto that. So they'd have to agree to equal distribution. And what Palmer pointed out was that the more productive could also threaten to hold out and say, well, if you insist, saying to the less productive, well, if you insist on equal distribution, then we're not going to agree to anything. And, you know, you'll have to come to accept what we say, or we're all going to starve. So each group could kind of threaten to hold out, and the resulting distribution would just depend on the bargaining ability of the participants. It wouldn't be determined just from the way they promised and stated what sort of distribution you get. Now, the interesting point here is that Palmer is, I think, is right about this. So Cohen can't claim that self-ownership plus collective property rights directly leads to a form of socialism where you have equal distribution. But Cohen could still say that if you begin with collective rights, you don't have to end up with something that looks like the libertarian solution. And it would just depend on distribution, would depend on whatever the people agreed to in that society. So it wouldn't have to be similar to what the libertarian society would come up with. Remember, his second suggestion was you immediately start with equal distribution of resources to anyone. Now, one kind of personal interest item here is that Palmer thought that this objection was not, he hadn't just shown that there's a problem with a particular step of Cohen's argument. He thought he undermined Cohen's entire argument against libertarianism completely. So he thought he really destroyed the basis of Cohen's rejection of libertarianism, kind of dealt Cohen a fatal blow. And to say, I don't think he did this, he was right on this point that Cohen rephrased the argument, so he still made an essential point. But because Palmer thought that he'd come up with this crucial objection destroying Cohen, he thought Cohen had conspired to prevent his article pointing out this crucial objection from being published in leading journals. So he thought Cohen realizes that Palmer has destroyed his system, but he's kind of, well, doesn't want people to find out about this, so he's doing everything possible to block Palmer from publishing it. So I think this is one reason Palmer really hated Cohen. He was very, very violent to his gender. I don't think Cohen, in fact, I don't think Cohen thought the point was that important. Now, just because Cohen had that much influence, well, remember he was professor at Oxford. He was extremely highly regarded as a political philosopher. He was one of the top in the world, so he would have some influence. I don't think if someone had come up with a really crucial objection to Cohen, I don't think he would have been able to block it from coming out. But that was the way Palmer took it, anyway. So we have then the case that Cohen's basic point is, look, if you start with self-ownership, you accept self-ownership, you're not logically required to accept libertarian ownership of property because you need the additional step of saying that land or other resources start out on own. So how the question comes up is, we're libertarian, is how can we respond to Cohen's point? Well, I think we can admit that he's right, that the claim that land and resources start on own is not a consequence of self-ownership. Cohen is right, is an additional principle. But does this matter? Has he come up with any kind of convincing argument against the libertarians by pointing out this additional premise? Well, I don't think so, because we could ask, why should we think that people have inherent property rights, the kind Cohen suggests? We suggest people start off with collective property rights, or they start off with rights to equal distribution of resources. So why should we accept that rather than the alternative that property or land starts out unowned and then it has to be something to acquire? Here I think we just have to think about and see which one way of looking at responding is more plausible. So we think that we should just say, well, people have to do something to acquire property, or should we think that Cohen is right, people have inherent property rights? At least it seems to me that the assumption that land starts off on own is the more plausible one, the one that we would naturally think of when we think that if there's a property claim that has to be met to acquire the property in some way. Now, suppose you said then, well, we want to compare libertarian ownership, where you acquire property by homesteading, with the systems collective ownership. So you want to say, well, which one do you suggest? Well, I say you could make some kind of judgment of plausibility, but maybe you could make it more systematic in trying to decide what to do. So maybe you could have arguments that collective ownership is somehow better, the system of collective ownership somehow better than the libertarian system. Now, Cohen doesn't directly argue that collective ownership is desirable. Instead, he attacks the libertarian approach. He says, if you start off with self-ownership and then you assume that the property is land is unowned, you allow, say, people can then homestead land in the way that we'd be familiar with. So if you read the offer, he says, this system will allow morally bad outcomes. Now, unfortunately, when he's considering libertarianism, he selects Nozick to count. And remember, we talked about Nozick last week. Nozick decides to do his argument for a minimal state that I discussed last week. He also has a discussion in the second part of Anarchy State each other, how we acquire property. So he selects Nozick to count as the only libertarian system in his family. Now, Nozick's system has a feature that gives Cohen an opening to attack. Now, if you took Rothbard's system in Ethics of Liberty, Power of Market, it doesn't have this controversial feature. So Cohen is launching attack on libertarianism, but he's selecting just this one particular system that is found in Nozick's version of libertarianism, not in others. I think that's a general weakness of his approach, that he just considers taking Nozick really to be the only libertarian system he needs to look at, the one he was most familiar with, because of course Nozick was a very big name in philosophy, so it's the one he naturally be aware of. So in the standard libertarian fiction, we've already gone over this point, so we can just go over it very quickly. Libertarian theories start from self-ownership, and as Cohen suggests, the premise that land and resources start on own. Individuals can then acquire property by doing something very aggressive, homesteading. There are different views of what exactly you have to do. What do you have to do to acquire the property? Law talks about labor mixture. There are people who don't like that language. I think Stefan Kinsella doesn't like the idea of mixing your labor. And so the linguistic object. objection to it. You have to do something to acquire the property standard for the maturity view. Now, Nozick adds a feature to the standard picture. He accepts standard picture, but you start off with individuals who are self-owned, the land is unowned people, do something to the land to acquire it. But he adds another feature where he follows, here he follows John Locke. He says, if you appropriate land, your doing so can't leave anyone else worse off. So it isn't enough, say, here's the land out there, I'm going to fence off an area and homestead it. That isn't enough in Nozick's theory. You also can't leave anyone else worse off. Now, there's a problem here. If you put in this feature, which you referred to as the Lockean proviso, and this feature, the way Nozick takes it, isn't exactly the way Locke took it. But what we're talking about here is the way Nozick takes it. So it's not clear what's involved with saying that if you acquire property, you're not leaving anyone worse off. But the way Nozick seemed to take it was that as long as people are in general are better off from having a system of individual property ownership or would be otherwise, then you're not leaving people worse off. There are different ways to take it. So you want to know, well, why did Nozick put this principle, this proviso in? We don't find it proper. Well, I think one reason he put it in is he didn't think that there's a fully satisfactory principle of first appropriation. So he didn't think there's a way that if you left this proviso out, he didn't think you could really come up with a good principle of saying why people can acquire property. But there is such a principle, but you didn't know what it is. So if you, by adding the proviso, you're making up for the fact that you can't come up with a satisfactory principle of first appropriation. So, well, I can't really justify something that would show why you can acquire property, what you have to do to unown land to acquire it. But as long as you're doing something and you fulfill the proviso, then this is the best we can do. Now, this use of proviso gives Cohen an opening for attack. And he really reduces the libertarian account of property acquisition to the just to the proviso. So again, this is extremely important to understand what Cohen is saying. Again, in the standard version, libertarian, kind of the Rothbardian version, is you homestead an area, say you fence off an area, you do some work in there, you farm something, you do something. So this gives you ownership rights in the property. So what Cohen does, and this isn't actually what Nozick does, it's just the way Cohen takes it, he gets rid of this part where you do something to the property, you have to do something to the property to acquire it. He says all you need to do to acquire property according to the libertarians, according to his way of reading Nozick, is that when you acquire property, you don't make anyone else worse off. So for him, all I have to do to acquire property is I can acquire all the property I want as long as I don't make anyone else worse off. Now, that might seem a bit confusing, but let me give you an example. I think it'll make it clearer what he has in mind. Suppose someone is farming land, let's say, and I've gone out and just sort of fence off a certain area and start working it. But I didn't say I appropriate this land. I'm just working the land. Just farming it for a while. then Cohen says that it would be all right on Noah's experience. Remember, Cohen isn't saying Cohen thinks it was right. He's saying on the libertarian theory that Nozick had, it would be all right for someone else to appropriate the land as long as the farmer didn't suffer loss of income. Supposing, say, imagine I'm a developer and I can use this land for some very lucrative purpose. I could say, well, I could combine this particular farm with some other area and build some big store on it and I'd make a lot of money. So out of the tremendous profits I've made from this store, I can pay the person I've appropriated so he doesn't suffer any loss of income. So on this way of doing things, as long as I'm not making, I can appropriate the farm because I haven't made the farmer worse off. He still has the same income he had before, but I can compel transfer because all I need to do to appropriate property is not to make anybody else worse off. So this is rather like eminent domain, where the state says they're the final owners of all the property in the country, so they can pay you the market value for your property, and then they can acquire and take it over. So here it's different because the people whose land is taken over aren't the owners of it. They're just using the land, and here somebody else can appropriate it and say, come say, well, I now own this property, and all you have to do to appropriate it is to compensate anyone who would be made worse off by the appropriation. So see, this one says, well, isn't this a bad outcome? People wouldn't want to say this, but you can just force people, you can just take over what land other people are using and get all these big profits from it, just if you don't make them worse off, doesn't this seem like an unfair thing to do? So he says, well, no, the libertarian account allows this. It's a morally bad outcome. So this is a good reason to reject what Nozick is saying. But of course, I'm sure, since I'm probably people in the class are very familiar with libertarian theory, you can see this isn't really a good objection to at least the standard libertarian picture, because in the libertarian answer to Cohen would be the farmer would already be the owner of the land. Remember, in his example, is somebody's farming particular land, and then somebody else comes along and says, well, he didn't appropriate the land, just using it. Didn't say, I appropriate the land, didn't do anything to make him the owner. So I can now take over what he's done and use it for my purposes as long as I compensate him so he doesn't lose any income. So I think the standard picture would be when the person is using the land, that's sufficient for this first person to appropriate. So there's no room for somebody else to come in and say, well, I hereby appropriate the land, it's already been taken by the first person's activity. And in a libertarian view, you can't appropriate someone else's land just by compensating. You can't compel the person to transfer his property to you just because you say could put it to the use that where you could get more money than he can and you can pay him so he wouldn't be losing it. And I think the reason, this is a pretty obvious answer, and the reason Cohen was an extremely smart person listed was that he wrongly took the libertarian account of property to be just this proviso, thought that all the libertarian account of property acquisition is this principle. You can acquire property as long as you don't make anybody worse off. And of course, that the proviso isn't the main part of libertarian theory. not bound in what I call the standard picture of unitarian theory that you get in Rothbard. It's just a particular detail added in those existence, and it isn't even it's just an addition to even those existence. It isn't the sum and substance of Nozick's theory of property acquisition, it's just part of it. So Cohen's criticism here is really missed the boat entirely, I think. Now, suppose, though, we accept, that, as we say, that Cohen, I think you said we do accept it, that Cohen is right that self-ownership doesn't lead to libertarianism. So he's saying, look, you can accept self-ownership, but you don't have to accept libertarianism. Cohen still has a big problem. Remember, he's an egalitarian socialist. He thinks we should have a system where at least considerable state ownership of property, and we should have incomes where there aren't large inequalities. And it's very difficult to reconcile self-ownership with socialism, even if you accept Cohen's point that you don't have to, self-ownership doesn't commit you to a libertarian property acquisition. It's still hard to reconcile self-ownership and socialism. Now, this the basic point here, I think, has already been suggested, I think, by Leslie in one of the comments, is suppose we start with individuals who have equal shares of all the resources. We start with kind of collective ownership, and they've all agreed somehow on equal share, even if Palmer's argument has shown they don't have to, but that's what they do agree. Or we just start off with the assumption that people have equal shares of all resources. This situation could still lead to inequality. We know the famous world changing example. Remember, the example is we start off with people that equal amounts of money, and then Chamberlain puts up a basketball hoop in his backyard in the organized game. He just puts up, charges a quarter admission for anyone who wants to see him. So a lot of people want to see him, so he gets a lot more money than most people have because they're all giving him their quarters. So we start off with equal shares, but then we get an unequal distribution. So if we wanted to preserve, it would be very hard then to preserve the socialism, the equal distribution, that we have to keep interfering with what people do with the shares that Bonifacius thinks that they're entitled to. So if you say, well, people are self-owners and they start off with equal share of resources, then you're still not going to be able to get socialism. So how did Cohen cope with this difficulty? Well, what he did was, he said, well, ultimately, even though self-ownership is plausible, we have to reject it. So it isn't, if you reject self-ownership, then it isn't up to people always up to people to do whatever they want for their own bodies and property. So we could deal with the situation and say, even if we're saying you have the right to, these are your resources, with your equal share of resources, you don't have the right to distribute it to however you want. You don't have the right to act so that Wilt Chamberlain gets a lot more money than other people. The state can still come in and compel you to take Chamberlain's money, even though people have freely given it to him. So Cohen is saying, well, if socialism is incompatible with self-ownership, then I'm going to reject self-ownership. But then Cohen has yet another problem. Always giving problems for Cohen, is that self-ownership seems a correct principle. And Cohen himself is recognizing, what about the eye transplant case? We wouldn't want to say that just because blind people would benefit from eye transplant, that therefore the state can force you to give up one of your eyes line, do we think that Cohen goes back on that just because he's not going to be able to support socially? So what his answer is here, he says, is that the eye transplant case and other cases like that, it just shows the right to the integrity of your body, not full self-ownership. So we would say the state can't take away parts of your body to give to others, but it doesn't follow from that point, that principle, that the state can't, say, compel you in certain circumstances to labor for others, or to, we can't, that it can't interfere with self-ownership. In other words, you say, maybe all that this eye transplant case shows is that you have a right not to have your body cut up or distributed. But I think if we look at the eye transplant case just motivating more general acceptance of self-ownership, I think Cohen is really having to resort to rather desperate straits to get around the implication that a very plausible principle, maybe self-ownership, is inconsistent with socialism. Okay, well, I think we'll finish at this point and let Cohen have it. So I'll have a question. I see a question on the procedure, Giuseppe. The way we do it is I usually lecture for an hour, and then we have the rest of half hours for it, where you can ask questions or have discussion. So that's the way we usually do it. It wouldn't, you know, sometimes might work out a little bit differently, but that's the usual way to do it. All right, so do we have questions? I imagine it doesn't sound like people in the class are too sympathetic to Cohen's solution. He had very good jokes, I can tell you that. Okay, Giuseppe. Someone says, look at John's question right above. All right, well, let's look at John's question. Let's see, where is John? I'd like to look at John's question, but I'm not finding it. John asked, does he give an explanation for the theory of partial self-ownership? Well, he just says that his basic account is that he thinks this notion of equality is very plausible. He thinks it's unfair that some people get much more than others, say, because they're have greater abilities or their services are in demand. It's wrong that some people do much better than others, largely for factors that are due to luck. Say, imagine that, Michael Jordan got a great deal of money because he had outstanding basketball ability. So, well, he's not really fully responsible for that. He just happened to be born with a great deal of talent. And plus, he's lucky that basketball, being very good at basketball, is something that people are in very high demand. So Cohen thinks, and I certainly don't share this view, but he thinks it's very plausible that this kind of inequality due to luck should be eliminated or reduced at any rate. So he's thinking that this, if you're talking about self-ownership, well, in the cases where you'll see that you think, well, it would be very wrong to force people to benefit others, these cases will involve appeals to body, the person's integrity of the person's body. He thinks if you're talking about redistribution, say, of labor or income, then he doesn't think that the self-ownership principle is plausible there. So that's why it'd be just partial self-ownership. You have a right to the integrity of your body, but not much beyond that. Jot said, can the owners of his nowhere to put our feet down on the earth? Is that kind of a standard George's point? Well, I mean, I think they're sort of someone who wasn't a Georgist would just say that people's property rights don't extend to the point where they can require somebody just to leave all for all territory, even if everybody's own. People would have still have the right to stay in some place. So it wouldn't require kind of a Georgian solution or anything. Charles said, isn't the idea of fairness related to Rawls' kind of original position? Well, Rawls is partially motivated by rejection of luck in the way that Cohen is, but Cohen doesn't particularly use Rawls' original position. So you're right that there's a relation between what one of Cohen's basic principles and what's motivating Rawls. And in fact, Cohen criticized Rawls for not being egalitarian enough. If you read reading for next time, is actually a review that Cohen did of Rawls' work. It's a long discussion of Rawls. You see my review where I cover the differences between Cohen and Rawls. Now, Patricia said, the state is not able to take away parts of your body. It's still able to mortgage the population's future being constant. Yes, I think Patricia is certainly right that the present state is acting in lots of ways that are inconsistent with this self-ownership principle. That's a very good point that you made. Matt says, on the subject of the homestead, do you give much weight to a biological argument? Defining that the brain has a mapping of person to space, and the map increases in size as a tool in the space. I'm not quite clear on how this the biological argument would be supposed to go. I mean, supposing it would show people from the fact that people have a certain area of the brain that we call a mapping of personal space, I'm not clear how anything immediately follows about what rights they have to acquire property. I mean, let's imagine, say, that here's probably an example that would get me into trouble. Supposing people, say men, have certain areas in their brain that light up or behave in special ways where they're attractive women come into view, or women have certain areas in their brain where it's suddenly very attractive men will come into view. Nothing would follow on what rights they have to relationships with these people just because there are certain things taking place in the brain. So I'm not seeing how that argument would be supposed to go. Charles asked, what justifies the implicit assumption we have only one? I think that Cohen isn't suggesting that his able inferring examples with math, or to use the word that come up in the previous question, conditions in the real world. He's just using this word example to indicate how bargaining would take place under a situation. So collective ownership. But I mean, if there were different distributions of favor and influence, that would probably affect how far they would take place. But he doesn't need to specify this exactly to make his point, because remember, what his point is that he wants to show libertarianism doesn't lead, I mean, self-ownership doesn't lead to libertarian property acquisition, because we have the extra step that property starts off on loan, so he's just mentioning a kind of collective alternative to this assumption line starts on loan. So the particular detail of what would be decided on under this collective ownership line, I don't think there's significance here. I think it was problem with Palmer's argument is that he's too caught up with this, these particular questions of detail. Oh, well, I can show that Cohen was wrong to say that you come up with an equal distribution, so I'm really not calling out, but it's really just a spot, a side issue. Now, let me see, did I miss anything? Okay, Leslie says, if inequalities are unethical, and wouldn't Cohen ultimately have to argue that all differences between individuals and differences in appearance and effect should be eradicated? Well, I think what he's arguing is not that differences between people are unethical, but that benefiting from the differences in ways that get you more of income and more goods that people want is the part of this question. So he wouldn't say, again, that if Michael Jordan is a better player, basketball player, than I am, that there's something ethically wrong with that. Well, anybody's a better basketball player than I am. There's nothing ethically wrong with that. The questionable part for him is just that Michael Jordan got a lot more money out of his skill than I get out of whatever skills I have. So see, I don't think he would require that kind of eradication. But also, I mean, he wouldn't, another point that's very important to Cohen, justice is just one of the values. So even if, and I don't think the case, only justice that we have to get rid of all differences among people. As I said, I don't think it does require things that wouldn't follow. But supposing it did, then he wouldn't have to say that this should be done because there might be some other value, such as liberty, that overrides this, but it has to be considered also. So now someone asked, did Cohen ever respond to a criticism I raised against him in my book, Resurrection Mark? Well, I know he read the book, but I don't think he never wrote to me about it. I did a review of the assigned reading for week three. I did a review of Cohen's book, and he read that review and told me he liked the review, but and he was going to comment on that, but unfortunately he died shortly after that. So I never really knew what he said. He probably, I don't think he would, not that well known, I don't have to pay much attention to what I said, but he had read my stuff, so I don't know what he really thought of it. Now, Charles, is Cohen still?
Charles says that the numbers 3 and 4 are resolved.
Hello? Yes, I thought he was an extremely good argument. He was an extremely gifted philosophical critic. I mean, he was a very likable person. So I do think very highly, and I think certain points he raised can be used certain point that Marxism and against Rawl could be used very much in a libertarian way, although that was the way he took it. Okay, let's see. Have I missed any? Okay, we still have about 15. We have another 15 minutes. Maybe I can. You know, I said Colin had some good jokes. I'll give you an example of one of his comments. He once said, Colin was Jewish. He once said he was giving a lecture in Norway, and after his lecture, a woman came up to him and said, "Are you a Jew?" Well, I guess you had to be there to laugh. And he did very good imitations. He did a very funny imitation of Isaiah Berlin. I think you can listen to that on YouTube. Okay, so we have everybody's clear on Cohen there. We have some other points. Which are his books? Well, I think one is, I recommend everything by him, but one is this one is in your next week. You have to pick one. I'd say this one that is the subject of your next week's reading is called Rescuing Justice and Equality. I think that was one of his top books. So I would recommend that. But anything by him is worth reading. I had a short one, which I don't think was that good. I reviewed that very briefly. It was just something on why socialism. It was just a very short book, so I don't think that's good. But if you read this one, Rescuing Justice and Equality, I think you'll see this is a very powerful thinker. Now, since people are asked, let me ask, have people who are here read much Cohen or Nozick? Someone's asked a question here. Jesse wants to know, why is Cohen significant in the scholarly circle and why he has so much influence? Well, the main reason he was influential was in philosophy. What's very important is not so much the conclusions you come up with, but sort of the way you argue for it and how you, is particularly one skill that's extremely highly valued, is if you can show problems with arguments, and you can come up with all sorts of distinctions and show problems in people's arguments. And Cohen was one of the best with that. I mean, he was extremely good at showing how to structure an argument, what was wrong with it. And Nozick, incidentally, was also one of the absolutely best at this. So the two of them had very opposite ends of the political spectrum. They were both had this extremely important ability to analyze arguments. And I think that they were both considered there. They were considered, they raised, one thing Cohen was not, they raised very deep issues, say, what is the basis if we believe in equality, as most of the people in the field do, libertarians don't, but that's a minority view. You want to raise what is the basis of equality. Now, Danny wants to do analytic Marxism indulging polylogic. The simple answer that is no. You see, they, one thing they do when they apply analytic philosophy is they accept ordinary logic. So they're trying to come up with Marxist arguments supported by ordinary logic. They don't say, well, even if you think that you can show socialism, it's impossible. This is just because you're using bourgeois capitalist logic. This is valid proletarian logic. They don't go in for nonsense like that. But because they rely on ordinary logic, they really haven't been able to sustain the main tenets of Marxism. So this is why they weren't very popular among Marxists. A lot of convention Marxists thought the analytic Marxists were really giving up the essentials of the whole system. So that's why the movement has is really not as influential as it used to be. Now, Jessica, did Cohen view Russia as a feudalist country at the time of the revolution? Well, I don't think he wrote much. I can't recall that he wrote on the Russian Revolution much. Now, the standard Marxist position, which you find in Lenin's book, The Development of Capitalism in Russia, is that although Russia had certainly feudal elements, there was a capitalist system developing in Russia that was strong, it was more developed than most people thought, many people thought it was. Now, let's see, Aiden says, Cohen says he first had the right legal to bring in all the research. Does he have an argument for this? Well, he tends to take equality as something that's intuitively very plausible. I mean, he said, suppose you said something like we, libertarians, would say, each person has a right to liberty. We don't want a system where some people have much more liberty than others, so we don't want a system where there's a master class and a slave class. We kind of take it as evident that everyone should have the same rights. Everyone should have the right of self-ownership. It isn't just I own myself, but maybe you don't. So Cohen took equality to be kind of a basic intuitive principle, just like we would take self-ownership and say, well, you know, it's something that is just obvious that people don't deserve to benefit by luck or superior ability. I think there's one reason, the difference in what you take to be plausible, intuitive plausible, is one reason we have disagreements in political philosophy and ethics. So some people say, well, I think everybody should be equal. And say, I would say, no, I don't see that at all. I just don't have the intuitive judgment. So that makes, that's one reason sometimes libertarians have a bit of trouble in conventional philosophy departments that we don't have the same judgments on cases that a lot of the people who are prominent in the class. Okay, we have a few more minutes. Does anybody think Cohen was right? It doesn't look like it so far. Let's see, am I missing anybody down here? I guess it's oh, here's another one. Aiden says he finds equity more obvious than equality. Well, I do too, good for you. But remember, Cohen would say equity just is equality, so you're not maybe. Danny wants to know, did Cohen think socialism was never? No, he didn't. He thought that this is a choice people have to make. And he thought he couldn't refute himself arguments that socialism just won't work, or say that Jesus agreed. He didn't accept these arguments, but he didn't really have time to answer them. But he thought that if it turned out that, say, Mises was right and capitalism is the only feasible alternative, I think Mises was right, the way he had a very convincing argument, you just can't have economic calculation under socialism, so we don't have any alternative to the free market. Interventionist measures will fail from the view of the people who themselves advocated. Cohen would say to that, well, if that's true, then this is very unfortunate because we're going to be compelled to accept an ethically undesirable system. So he would say, if it turns out that we have to have a free market, that would be a very bad state of affairs. Now, Jock says he enjoys my Mises View lecture. Well, good for you, Jock. I like your style. Good for you. And Jock is going to think about the proviso here. Did Cohen believe in the labor theory of value? Well, he didn't. I don't think he didn't really commit himself on that. He put a lot of emphasis into his characteristic of Cohen into a very careful reformulation of the labor theory. Just to give you samples of the way he thinks, he said, people take the labor theory to be that the value of a commodity is the labor time required to produce it. And he said, no, this is kind of a just characteristic Cohen, but no, it's not the labor time required to produce it. It's the value of the labor that would be required to produce it. So not something that would, the labor that has been required to produce the commodity, but that would be required to produce it. Also, Jock says that my lecture is gelled well with the stuff we're doing with stuff on his topic course. And Jock, what was the stuff I was saying that was compatible with what Stefan is doing? I'm not surprised to hear what you said, but just what were you referring to in particular? Now, Danny says, it coincides like more like a socialist in general. And Marx said, I think that's right. He'd abandoned large parts of Marxism so at the end. So he was somebody who just kind of he thought socialism is kind of an ethical system. And so I see that my lecture from using to epistemology were like Hopper's discussions of empiricism. Yes, I think that's right. It is quite compatible views. Justin said, Palmer not only thought Cohen was a Marxist, he maybe didn't in this particular argument, but he thought he was really he thought Cohen really never abandoned support for Soviet Russia, which I don't think was true. So Palmer took Cohen to be a communist. And at one time, Cohen was a member of the Communist Party, but he gave it up, but Palmer was really convinced that he did give it up. Let me see. Leslie wants to know. First we have a question. What Ryan and Cohen's Palmer basic support. I think what he's done, he took certain passages where Cohen was saying when the Soviet system was overthrown, he felt bad that all the hopes he had before were shattered. He takes it to indicate he was still pro-communist, but I tend not to interpret it that way. Unless he said, would Cohen allow for a political system with more than one party? And he seems generally sympathetic to political liberties. He didn't really view it that much. And Well, I think there have, Jock suggests he couldn't hold an Oxford chair as a member of the Communist Party. Well, I think there have been communists who had high positions in British academic life. Eric Hobsbawm is a very prominent historian. If people taught it, Oxford and Cambridge, you were communists, so I don't think that would have stopped him. Yes, that's it. Jock had made it Cambridge and not Oxford. Well, they had communists at Oxford, too. Oh, yes, a funny remark from Picasso. Yes, good point. Well, I guess we're about out of time now, so next week we're going to talk about the most influential of all the political philosophers, John Rawls. So I hope we'll see you all next week. Thanks very much, everybody. Hope to see you next week. Bye, everybody.